Jenny Lawrence, a former trustee and longtime member of the library, city's oldest, founded in 1754 by a group of civic-minded people intent on creating a public library that would be very useful as well as ornamental to the city. The intervening 263 years have made the library one of New York's enduring institutions. Please support our program. But the library is a mere blip in time compared to our subject tonight, yoga, which over the years has morphed well beyond its ancient roots to take on a life of its own into new age religion, psychology, sports medicine, biomedicine, and cultures throughout the world. When the UN General Assembly declared June 21st the day of yoga, yoga achieved truly globalized status. Where do yoga traditions come from? Our speakers, Jim Mallinson and Mark Singleton, have parsed its development through textual history. Jim read Kipling's Kim when he was about 14 or 15 about a young English boy traveling around India with a holy man. At 17, Jim himself took a year off between school and university and spent 7 months in India. He's gone back every year since. His Oxford BA is in Sanskrit and Old Iranian. His MA from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies, or SOAS, was on the place of ascetic yogi in Indian society. His Oxford doctorate, a translation of 14th century text on key techniques of Hatha Yoga. He's been described as a polymath yoga expeditionary, as his various yoga-related ventures have ranged from filmmaking and exhibitions to judging and paragliding. He's published 8 books, all of which are translations of Sanskrit yoga texts, epic tales, and poetry. At SOAS, where he's a lecturer in Sanskrit and classical Indian studies, he's been leading a 5-year European Research Council-funded project to chart the history of Hatha Yoga practice by means of philology. Mark Singleton is a senior research fellow on this project. He came to the project after discovering the Cambridge University Library in 2011 text, describing an early 20th century Danish system of dynamic exercise called primitive gymnastics. Picture after picture showed men and women in familiar postures, warrior pose, downward dog, headstand, handstand, everything you might expect in a manual of yoga asana. Discovering this text led Mark to look at the roots of his own yoga practice. At Cambridge, in 2002, Mark was a research assistant at Durham Hinduja Institute of Indic Research and went on to complete his doctorate at Cambridge's Faculty of Divinity. Then he taught for 7 years at St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, later moving to Jodhpur, India, as a research scholar at the American Institute of Indian Studies. He's the author of 3 previous books about yoga. Tonight, we'll hear from 2 of the world's leading experts about the role of yoga, past and present. Please join me in welcoming Jim Mallinson and Mark Singleton, who will be in conversation with Daniel Simpson.
Closer, how's that?
Very good.
Okay, very good. So yes, that sort of those modern forms of yoga that we see all around us here in New York, that we see in London, and those were my focus for quite a long time. And I've been looking at the ways that these yogas have transformed in dialogue with other sort of philosophies, other outlooks on what it is to be human, let's say, other kind of technologies of the body that have made yoga into something arguably quite different than it was in India and in the recent and the not so recent past. At a certain point, I thought it would be useful and necessary to also start looking back at older traditions. And I sort of had in my mind an idea for a book very much like this one that would present a kind of primary sources. So not a book about yoga, not a book by, say, you know, an academic about what yoga really is, but a book that presented yoga in the words of its own practitioners, because there really wasn't anything like that out there, and I thought, who better to work with than Jim? And so about, gosh, what, 6 years ago, in fact, last time we were, last after another trip to the United States, I suggested to Jim that we put this book together. And I was looking through my emails the other day, where I was blithely suggesting that we would do this it would take us a year, very easy to do. And then 5 years later, we were still going. But that's how I, that's really how I came to, how I came to this book.
So Jim, you've really come at it from the other direction. Wandering around India with dreadlocked holy man who grown your own dreadlocks, obviously, as well, and really living the life of the yogi as it seems to have been since time immemorial. So you perhaps come at this from the other end of history. Could you tell us a little bit about your own background intellectually?
Yeah, that's quite right. First of all, I'd just like to say thanks very much to Jenny for the kind introduction and for putting this on. I've not been here before. What a wonderful benefit. Thanks to Sarah also for organising it. So yes, that's absolutely true. And as Jenny said, when I was, everyone hear me okay? Got it in the right place? When I was, after I'd left school and before I went to university, I came to India for 7 months. And it was actually near the end of that trip that I had my first sort of, I fell in with a bunch of these wandering yogis in Kashmir, and they were about to go on this pilgrimage at this mountain. And I had they had this sort of, roguish sort of vagabond style wandering ascetics, and at the same time they have these, this incredibly these technologies of the body, as Mark would put it, and that I think it was the from then on, every time I came back to India, I would search these people out, these yogis out, and I think it was the third year after that when I came back, so I was sort of near the end of my undergrad degree, and I realised that I really wanted to get a good understanding of this world. I would need to become part of one of their actual traditions. So I went to one of these huge festivals where there are millions and millions of, the last one, they reckon 100 million people turned up at this Kumbh Mela festival. And they were a bit smaller in those days, 20, 25 years ago, but I went there with the intention of finding a guru, basically, and getting initiated into one of these lineages, and that's a long story in itself, but it worked out very well indeed. I was very lucky to end up with this charismatic guru who was renowned for his mastery of various yoga practices. And so, but I'm unfortunately, unlike these yogis in India, well, unfortunately or fortunately, I'm not sure, I'm not able to abandon the sort of life of the mind completely. And I'm a scholar. I'm constantly questioning what's going on, why they were doing these things, what the historical context was, just trying to understand their whole world. And so I would keep the two parallel worlds going on, of living with these yogi traditions in India, and then studying them through scholarly methods back in England. And so after my BA, which was in Sanskrit, in which I wasn't able to sort of focus on that world at all, but it gave me a very good language training, I then decided to do a MA in anthropology. So that would sort of justify going back for more fieldwork trips to hang out with the yogis. And that was great, actually. That was at SOAS, and I loved that. And that's when I really kind of got inspired and decided I wanted to be an academic. But I didn't, in those days, that was the early 90s, and anthropology was particularly bogged down in theory, and it was a sort of nightmare. And you spent much more time studying the theory of the methods that you're doing rather than what you actually wanted to study. So I decided I'd turn my back on that, and for my PhD, I decided to go back and use my Sanskrit skills to study this world of the wandering holy men. And the only texts in Sanskrit of any real relevance to that world that I was part of were the ones on yoga, on physical yoga practices. And so I decided to edit, to do a critical edition of a text called the Khichdi Vidya, which is about this very esoteric yoga method where you turn your tongue back into the cavity above your palate in order to supposedly drink the nectar of immortality, which is dripping down from the top of your cranium. And it's also a sort of rocket fuel, because it's also meant to give you the ability to fly. And by complete coincidence, that was the time when I started learning to paraglide, but that's another story altogether. That worked better for me, actually. Right? And I did learn the technique, the yogic technique, but that never got me off the ground.
I could just jump in there, Jim. I mean, that's a very different kind of yoga to what most people are used to seeing in you know, lycra pants. Perhaps we should start by just defining yoga. And the back cover of the book points out in a quotation from the yoga text that yoga is to be known through yoga. So it is both the means and the end. Then there are in the first chapter, I think, 61 extracts defining various different kinds of yoga, several of which contradict each other. So perhaps you could start, Mark, by putting a little bit of context into that mix of what exactly is yoga.
Indeed. Well, I think today when we talk about doing yoga, we have certain images come to mind, like lycra pants. But certainly it's something that you would do, whereas in most of the texts that we look at, the word yoga is referring actually to a particular state or to the goal that's to be achieved by doing these practices like posture, like breathing practices and lots of other practices that we go through in the book. And so yoga is the place that you get to. It's a place of refined cognitive awareness. But that in itself is not agreed upon. So the first chapter of the book gives these definitions. The final chapter of the book talks about these various states that are called liberation or isolation, wherein you're sort of somehow removed from mundane existence. Through these practices, you come out of your conventional identity, your conventional perception of reality, into these higher states. But of course, nobody can agree on exactly what these higher states are because they're so difficult to talk about. Or perhaps because there isn't a single final state that everybody gets to. So anyway, that's what yoga generally means. It's talking about this sort of the higher reaches of consciousness.
And in terms of the yogis you were spending time with, Jim, what were their actual practices? I've seen, certainly at gatherings of sadhus in India, all kinds of contortions of the body that are similar to what we see in a postural yoga class, but people seem to hold them for a very long time, like 40 years.
That's very true. And yes, I mean, some of our earliest references to these postures that people did. I think we have the passage in the book from Strabo's Geography, so in ancient Greek, and he talks about how Alexander the Great met these, they were called gymnosophists, sort of naked philosophers somewhere in what's now Punjab in India, Pakistan, and they would hold these very difficult postures. They would do it just for the day. You know, they would apparently come out of the town, go to some grove, and then assume a difficult posture, and hold it all the way through the day, and then the evening go back. But yes, we also, from pretty early on, get reports of people, as you say, holding their arms up in the air for for years on end, or standing up for years on end, and so forth. And that, I mean, that seems to me to be one of the big differences between how we, the yoga that we see today globally. Although, what I want to stress as well, that, that there's not like a complete disjunction, and we do see within India, and I think we show this in the book, that that there are forerunners also to the sort of the physical posture routines that we would recognise as yoga as well. But that's a sort of different stream from the classical ascetic yogi who is basically turning his back on the world. I mean, today we see, you know, yoga is kind of sometimes called as a quick fix. You can do your couple of sessions a week and that will make you work better, you know, and that'll fit into your, that make your busy schedule sort of run more smoothly. But it's where it originated amongst these ascetics, that's quite, you know, it's a completely different world. They're absolutely not going to work. They don't have jobs. They don't have families. They've turned their backs on ordinary life. And the practices that they will undertake, in particular these sort of difficult, you know, these extreme austerities, they are tied in with the mental practices of yoga, but they're thought to create this power within the body. And there are plenty of stories, myths, Indian Sanskrit myths, and again, I think we have one or two in the book, we have several hundred passages in there, and as it was a 5-year process, so I can't actually remember everything that's in there. So through doing these very extreme austerities, the yogis will build great power, and then the gods become sort of nervous about how they're going to become more powerful than they are, and they will try to distract them, or they'll give them whatever they want and ask them to stop, or sometimes if that doesn't work, they'll send some nymph to seduce them, because that's a foolproof way. Well, it's not foolproof, but if the nymph succeeds, then they will definitely lose their power. So this idea of gaining power as well as gaining liberation that Mark was talking about, these kind of higher mental states, is key to understanding of yoga in its sort of traditional formulations.
So let's turn a little bit to some of the texts in the book. As you say, there are a vast number of texts quoted here. Most people, if you were to ask them to mention a text on yoga, might perhaps refer to, if they were talking about a book with lots of colour photos and stretching, they might talk about the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, even the Bhagavad Gita or some of the Upanishads. What would they not be hearing that some of these texts are talking about if they were just to listen to what they found in the more popular yoga texts?
Let's start with the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. For example, that's often quoted as a kind of foundational text of yoga practice. Everybody knows it, and it's often taught in teacher trainings. There've been more translations of the Yoga Sutras in the past sort of 10 or 15 years than there have in the past 2,000 years. But there are many things that we see practiced later that don't appear. So, for instance, there's only a few very terse verses on postures, and a very limited number of postures are actually taught in there. So, if you're expecting to find an account of why yoga contains so many postures, and indeed is identified with posture often these days, you won't find it in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Each of these texts, that's not to say that the Yoga Sutras isn't a central text and that it hasn't been important all the way through that, you know, the history of yoga, that it hasn't been, that particularly this eightfold path hasn't been incorporated into many different systems of yoga, but it doesn't describe everything, it doesn't account for that history. And I hope that's sort of what we've done in the book, is to sort of provide an archaeology, to sort of show the way that these particular practices actually continue to develop and indeed to proliferate, so that what you have in 500 CE is not quite the same thing as you have in 1800. The Bhagavad Gita, just to comment briefly, presents a kind of yoga that is at the time fairly unique. It starts its own tradition. which is quite different from the kind of renouncing traditions that, that Jim was just speaking of. For example, it speaks of bhakti yoga, the yoga of devotion. So all you need to do as a practitioner of yoga in the Bhagavad Gita is to turn your mind and your heart to Krishna, to the ultimate, to God. And that's unusual. That's a kind of unusual move that then becomes very popular. And as we know, the Bhagavad Gita is one of the key texts of Hinduism. It's extremely popular, but it's sort of again quite far from the mainstream. So to think that we'll find those practices in the Bhagavad Gita would be wrong.
Yeah, it just teaches how to sit, doesn't it? It doesn't teach you the postures.
There are instructions on how to sit, yeah. But mainly, what you want to do is sort of, you know, devote your actions and your life to the Lord, to God.
Jim, thinking about some of the Hatha Yoga texts that come a bit later, what's missing if one was only to look at, say, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, as it's popular, you know, Hatha Pradipika, is that an effective guide to what's in some of the other texts that you've isolated here that were the source texts about?
Yes, absolutely. I think we make in the introduction to the book is that scholarship on yoga and the history of yoga until recently has just looked at, you know, two or three texts. One of them is this text called the Hatha Pradipika, which Daniel mentioned, which is written, it's actually compiled in about the 15th century, so not that long ago, 600 years ago, right, middle of the 15th century. But what it is, the Hatha Pradipika, it means the lamp on Hatha, and Hatha is the Sanskrit word that's used to denote physical forms of yoga practice. But what it's doing, that text, is we've identified now about at least 20 texts that it just borrows from, so it's like a compilation, it cobbles it all together. And it's kind of incoherent. They'll give different reasons for doing the same practice, and it's very hard to make sense of. So what we've been doing, a key part of our work, and this project that Mark and I are working on at the moment, central to that is we're producing editions and translations of 10 texts, of which I think 6 or 7 were used in the compilation of the Hatha Pradipika. And those individual texts actually present a coherent yoga practice, which you can understand. These later texts, which are kind of cobbled together compilations, are very, very confusing. So that's one of the things we're trying to do. I say those texts, they're coherent, but they're pretty esoteric practices as well. Some of them, it's not always absolutely straightforward what's going on in them either.
One of them that I heard you talk about recently, obviously, sprung a few surprises for you as well, in that it suggested a slightly different origin for some of these practices.
Yeah, that's one of the most exciting things of our recent research. And we do, it was long ago, just before we kind of finalised the book, we were able to get this into the book. And so the project that we're working on, we're editing from manuscripts 10 texts on physical yoga. So they range from about the 11th to the 19th century. And the first one is a text called the Amrita Siddhi, which means something like the attainment of immortality or something like that. And I've been reading this text from manuscripts for about 15 years. I got some 17th, 18th century manuscripts from Rajasthan, and it became immediately apparent that it's a foundational key text for understanding physical yoga. It's quoted in that the text I mentioned earlier, The Light on Hatha. But then a couple of years ago, I got hold of, it's a very complicated history, I got hold of scans of printouts from a microfilm of a manuscript that was in Beijing, has now apparently gone back to Tibet, may never be found again. But a scholar from Harvard, Leonard Van der Kuyt, in the 90s, he through various nefarious deeds in Beijing managed to get these microfilm printouts. And so and this manuscript is absolutely fascinating, bilingual Sanskrit and Tibetan, and then it has three registers of writing. You've got the Sanskrit, and then you've got the Sanskrit Tibetan script, and then you've got a translation in Tibetan. And I don't know Tibetan, but I've been reading it with a scholar in Oxford, a young scholar, Peter Santo, and we're doing an edition of the text, and he's absolutely brilliant at Tibetan. And as we read this text, as we read this manuscript, it became more and more apparent that the text was written by Buddhists. Okay, and the general assumption about yoga, and physical yoga in particular, has come from Hindu traditions. Now, actually, I mean, I don't want to labour this point too much because, you know, these kind of categories of Hindu and Buddhist we see as rather more distinct than they were then. 1,000 years ago, there was a much more kind of easy interplay between the two. But this has then opened up this whole new world to me about now having to educate myself rapidly in tantric Buddhism, which is a whole different subject, and extremely esoteric and good fun. But yeah, that's one of the big revelations, and we do get that into the book, I think, just about.
And it's not just Buddhism as well, is it? There are quotations also from Islamic sources and then Jain texts as well. So yoga is actually a lot more diverse and non-sectarian than certainly people in the Indian government might like to claim today.
That's true, and that's the point we try to make, that it's a sort of technology that can be adopted by... So yeah, we make the point that there's no yoga philosophy, and that the practices, the techniques of yoga can be used within any metaphysical, philosophical outlook. And just to pick up on the point about the Islamic texts, I mean, they don't appear until the 14th or 15th century, but they were clearly very, very interested in this. There was a lot of crossover between Sufis and yogis, and the earliest paintings we have of yoga postures are in illustrations to a Persian manuscript about yoga, which also goes into much more detail about the practices than any of the Sanskrit manuscripts we've got.
Coming a little bit closer to the present, Mark, I mean, a lot of your work has looked at cultural exchange and also this trend that we see in the tradition of borrowing, copying, changing things, rearranging, and yet at the same time, it's not quite clear how we got from this increasing proliferation of postures in the text to what we see today, where there are sequenced postures, people putting together a practice, linking postures together. Has there been any discoveries that might shed some light on how we got from one to the other?
Well, the final text that we're working on at the moment and that we've included extracts from in the text is, in the book, is a text called the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati, so a kind of instruction book on the practice of Hatha. And it's probably late 18th century. So it's our colleague Jason Birch who found this manuscript in a library in Pune. And it describes, probably for the first time, sequences, or at least grouping, six groups of postures, which some of which are intended to be practiced one after the other. It's very clear that the sort of these groups of postures. So prior to this, all you usually have is lists of postures, and those lists might be quite long. There are texts that contain many postures. But the question has always been, like, why sort of, you know, in the modern period have there been, is there such an emphasis on sequences? And various people, including myself, including Elliot Goldberg, who's sitting over there, have sort of, you know, offered various various ideas and reasons for this. But so the discovery of this text is quite key, that there is, apparently, there was a lot of experimentation with regard to these, how you would string postures together and do something that a bit more sort of aerobic, if you like, a bit more similar to what happens often in yoga classes these days. And this text is also particularly interesting because it was probably known, or a variant of the text, some copy of the text, was probably known to a teacher in Mysore in the 1930s called T. Krishnamacharya. We know that he knew a different text called the Sri Tattva Niti, which was a copy and a kind of garbled copy of this text that describes these sequences, where the scribe or whoever put together this later text, the Sri Tattva Niti, had pulled out, we don't know why, we don't know exactly what he was thinking, but had pulled out all these postures and rearranged them so that sequential nature was lost. But there's reason to think that Krishnamacharya himself might have known actually both these texts and possibly sort of got the idea for those sequences from this text, and those are the sequences that we sort of inherit these days. A lot of the sort of flow yoga, the dynamic yoga, stems from Krishnamacharya's teachings, or those of his students. So we're sort of working on that. I don't think we can quite say that, Krishnamacharya, got those sequences from this ancient source. There's a legend about a lost text called the Yoga Gurunta, which is supposed to be the source for these practices. And it just so happens that this text that we're working on is authored by one Kapala Kuruntaka. And the name Kuruntaka is suggestive of this sort of, this mysterious text, the Yoga Gurunta. So we're working on that. Jason Birch and I are currently writing an article, and we'll be putting that out fairly soon. But it's interesting, it's sort of suggestive. Like, I don't think enough work has been done on that sort of period between the last text in this book and the beginning of those sort of modern experiments that bring us up to the present day.
It does seem to be only in the modern era that these texts have been mined for instructions on practice by practitioners. They don't seem to be that rich a resource if you were a practitioner, say, 800 years ago, consulting a text that said, sit in the lotus position, put one leg on the other leg, sit for some time. It's very sparse, the sort of instructions we're getting. And in fact, the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, one of the texts that Jim's brought to our attention, talks about how it's all about practice. You're not going to get anywhere by reading the texts. And yet, it doesn't actually describe any practice, really. It's very sort of bare bones description. So, presumably, there was a teaching from a guru who was supposed to supplement all this. Are these then kind of the lecture notes on the teachings, or are they somebody else's second-hand understanding of what was shared with the students, or should they be read by practitioners?
It's a very good question, and one I don't think I can answer completely. It's sort of something I'm constantly asking myself, is why were these texts written? Because particularly these ones on physical practice that only started being written about 1,000 years ago. Yeah, as I said, we know from Alexander the Great that people were doing this stuff 1,500 years before that. So why do they suddenly start getting written down? Now, what it does say in these texts is that they're sort of, in some ways, introducing these practices to a wider audience. They're saying that people other than these professional ascetics who turn their backs on normal life and dedicate themselves permanently and constantly to the practice of yoga, they're saying that other people, normal people with normal lives can do a bit of yoga. That's the answer I've been giving until recently. But just recently, I was with a scholar, an Indian scholar up in the Himalayas. He lives in a place called Mandi, and he's just written this great book called A Prehistory of Hinduism. And he goes into the sort of political and economical background of the religious traditions during the period when these texts were first written down. And he's not addressing himself to these texts, he's just looking at other things. But as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking, well, this actually is providing the background to the traditions that produce the texts that I work on. And we see this constant tension in the text between this idea of the professional yogi who doesn't have a family, doesn't have a job, and just is constantly practicing yoga, and then the person who lives in the world, as we normally say. And in fact, going back to the Bhagavad Gita that Mark was talking about, that's the message, that's what's going on in the Bhagavad Gita as well, is that these people, these professional yogis who are kind of symbols of transcendence and saying you don't need to worry yourself with all this pointless, mundane life, you should be concentrating on God, they're a kind of threat to regular society. And so that's the point of the Bhagavad Gita, saying actually you don't need to turn your back on society. You can live in the world and be a yogi at the same time. And that, I think, is what's going on in these texts that start being produced about 1,000 years ago. But it's in a very specific context whereby the heads, the monastic heads of the lineages, the monasteries, start getting given land grants. So they start owning property. They start becoming very rich. And then the way that you pass on that property is through having children. Okay, and so what the texts are doing, they're trying to justify the heads of the monasteries living family lives and having children, and thereby, they don't say this, but this is what I think is going on, because there's a constant argument between whether you need to do the extreme practices or whether you can just live a normal life. And there are some quite bizarre you know, yogic techniques which are used to justify this argument. And I go back to this point I made about nymphs seducing yogis and thereby they lose all their power. Well, then there are these special yogic techniques which are introduced to these techniques in his text, whereby you can, you know, procreate let yet not lose your power. And I think this is what's going on.
Yeah, I seem to remember that there's a line in, I think it's the Shiva Samhita, which says, the householder has much fun having mastered these teachings. Fully for him. I'd like to come to a couple of quotations from the book, very brief, but seemingly contradictory, at least on the surface. You say towards the beginning that there is a, by the time that the book is sort of coming to a close, the end of the 18th century, British colonial rule in India, that there was a pervasive trans-sectarian consensus throughout India as to what constitutes yoga. And then, however, a little bit later when discussing postures, you say that actually even in pre-modern India, at the same period, there was no consensus as to which physical practices could be accepted as part of yoga. So that sort of sets up a little bit of a dichotomy between yoga and the physical practices. And then also this makes me wonder, what actually, you know, are the common factors in a lot of these texts that make you practice yoga as opposed to stretching or hanging out with a dog or drinking beer, as some of the more modern variants might have it.
Well, there is a consensus as to what yoga is, but there's also, you know, the walls, the barriers are permeable, and particularly with asanas, we see a kind of, you know, this proliferation that we've been talking about, and in other practices as well, such as these cleansing techniques, which are six in that Hatha Pradipika that Jim was talking about. But which also, you know, you start to get other techniques added, you know, how different ways to cleanse the body. And yet there are other other techniques like pranayama practice, which stay relatively stable. So you've got eight pranayama practices in the older text, and you have eight pranayama practices in most other breath control. Pranayama is breath control. But that sort of consensus is basically the model of Hatha Yoga that Jim's been talking about. And that starts to become accepted and assimilated into the mainstream from the 16th century onwards, 16th, 17th, 18th century, into, let's say, the Hindu mainstream, and to have new texts produced which sort of fit that practice, which formerly was sort of outside of that structure, into this sort of Vedic Hindu way of life. Particularly one body of text that has been called the Yoga Upanishad, so new texts, not the older Upanishads from, let's say, you know, sort of 2,000 years ago, but a new body of practices which represents this, which brings yoga into that kind of mainstream of life. What was the second bit? What is it that makes it yoga? it seems to, well, it depends who you ask, doesn't it? I mean, it depends who you ask, but usually it depends on initiation. It depends on there aren't any yoga initiations. I think we have one example of a particular yoga initiation, but I think to study yoga, to practice yoga, you would have to be initiated into a particular lineage, into a particular school. You'd have to belong to that particular school. So even though in some of these texts, like the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, it's said that, well, you can be a Buddhist, you can be you can be Shaiva, you can be Vaishnavi, you know, you can be a materialist who doesn't really believe in anything beyond the material body, and yoga will still work. But in practice, I think you would have to actually belong to one of these yoga practicing lineages. And of course, you know, what constitutes yoga tends to change in the modern day. And it seems to me that maybe everybody has a line that they don't cross, but that line varies. Some people will cross over into yoga for dogs, or what was it, goat yoga? Goat yoga, you know. So that those boundaries have become much more permeable, much more flexible, and that sort of key notion of a sampradaya, of a lineage that you would be initiated in and which you would remain in, has kind of gone, I think, in the sort of democratic marketplace of yoga that we have today.
Changing the question slightly for Jim, who has been initiated into a traditional lineage and honoured with a bit of title in recognition of his long and faithful service to his guru, perhaps. What is it that is being taught in that context, perhaps, that modern practitioners of yoga in a slightly more urban setting might not be doing? It's obviously difficult to say. I know you like to say you don't go to yoga classes, but at the same time, are there practices or ways of seeing, or even just ways of conceiving of what yoga is, that the average yoga student today might benefit from paying a little bit more attention to?
Yes, I mean, I think so. I'm not sure about the sort of goat yoga and the beer yoga. I used to say, until those things appeared, I used to say you can find sort of, you know, parallels for just about everything when you look in the history, but I don't think you can. Well, beer yoga, actually, you can in tantric traditions that, you know, will take alcohol and then some, of course. But the goats, I'm not sure about. I'm not quite sure what goat yoga is, but I was asked about it, I was interviewed about it, and I pretended I did, but I don't know. Anyway, the tradition that I'm part of, I mean, there's one, something that struck me a while ago. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, liminal. I occupy a liminal position because it's an ascetic tradition where they're, you know, these people are renouncers and they're, you know, they, and I go on about it again, their family life, they're itinerant, they don't, you know, they subsist off alms, you know, they'll never work for a living and so forth. And some of them do pretty extreme practices, including. There's one thing, again, which goes back to the time of the Buddha, the time of Alexander. We have some very old references to, in the hot season, so in the 4 months of the hot season, they will, in the middle of the day, sit surrounded by burning cow dung fires under the, you know, under the hot sun, and they'll meditate for a couple of hours. And this, again, is part of these practices of asceticism, which build up power within the body, and the power is identified as heat. In fact, the Sanskrit word tapas for this power and for these ascetic practices also means heat. And then some of them, at the end of doing that, you know, that couple of hours it normally is of meditation, and they'll be repeating their mantras and so forth, will do some yoga postures. Something occurred to me the other day, and in fact, a friend of mine, a sadhu, who's sort of not quite the same. Exactly the same lineage, but sort of a cousin of mine, effectively. He, I was speaking to him about it, and he said he only does his yoga postures in the hot season because that's when the body is supple and able to get into the more advanced position. And I couldn't help but think of Bikram yoga, you know, even though everyone knows about Bikram yoga, where you do it in a hot room and you get very hot and sweaty, and then you can assume more tricky postures. I don't think he, Bikram, although he's now run away, he's now gone into hiding because he's in deep trouble, like most of these yoga gurus seem to end up at the end of their careers at some point or other. Anyway, I think he's gone into hiding in India. But he at one point he was trying to copyright his whole system, wasn't he? But I don't think he did notice that parallel. But perhaps he could have claimed authenticity with
it. It might be a challenge to get people to do that in the same way as washing out their intestines in the river and some of the other practices we see in some of these texts. But just coming back to the modern era now and the project you're working on together at SOAS, wondering if you could give a little flavour of what people can expect in the coming years. What sort of output you have in mind? You mentioned some translations, but I know there are some other books that you're working on as well, and perhaps a film.
Yeah, okay, as I mentioned, the core outputs of the project are 10 critical editions of texts on physical yoga that had never been published or translated before, so we're working from manuscripts. And then there are four of us based at SOAS in London who we will each produce a monograph, a book about our sort of specialist areas. We're also, and Mark might say a bit about this, but we're delighted that it's looking pretty likely, I mean almost certain, that we're involved in an exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum, which will probably, I mean, I haven't got a date on it yet, I mean, but probably 2020, so we're helping it there. It's actually, this is a sort of side effect, a lucky break, thanks to the discovery of the that Amrita Siddhi text being Buddhist, because the exhibition is on Tantric Buddhism. When, so 2 or 3 years ago, they'd never even considered having us on board, but now, now because of that text, they've justified in getting us involved, and of course, they recognise the, you know, the great interest in yoga. And we, Mark and I, were both involved in the show at the Sacra Gallery of the Smithsonian in 2013, you know, which had 200,000 or 300,000 people came to it, so which is very good for a museum show. So that's another thing we're involved with. And there's the film, so actually maybe Mark's more closely involved with the film than I am, so maybe Mark might say something about that.
Well, it's a film of this text that I was talking about called the Hatha Vyasa Padati, which attempts to put together, to reconstruct these sequences for the first time on film. So that is with, again, Jason Birch and his wife, Jacqueline Hargreaves. And we've done it. We filmed it in London during the summer with some advanced Ashtanga yoga practitioners there. And that will be available soon. Some of the postures are so extreme that we couldn't find anybody to do them. So if there's any volunteers, you see me afterwards. So some of it will actually be filmed in India, I presume, well, sometime soon. And it's quite extraordinary. It's quite extraordinary. It doesn't look like the sort of modern sequences that we know today, but it really is quite unique and quite exciting. So there's that.
When Mark says some of the posters will be filmed in India, I think there are sort of schools of yoga schools for children in India, so you can get some extremely bendy young yogis.
That's
what we need. They're the only people we can find who are going to be able to do some of the stuff.
And there's also a practice that's not yoga, but that's a kind of allied practice called Malakamp, which involves doing extreme postures on a stick or a rope. And in this text, I think 10 rope postures are described. So those are also some of the things that we'll be filming in India. We should probably also mention, Daniela Bevilacqua, who's the ethnographer on the project, who's spending mostly all her time in India at the moment, interviewing yoga practicing sadhus. So going around, traveling around to all the melas, all the Kumbh melas that Jim was talking about, trying to get an idea of exactly what it is that people do in the name of yoga in these various lineages, and coming up with some really amazing data that nobody's really sort of thought to do that before. So that will be coming soon as well.
Exciting time to be involved in yoga studies. Well, thank you both very much for giving us an overview of what you've been doing and what we can expect. I'd like to just give everybody perhaps an opportunity to ask a couple of questions, if any come to mind. Please.
So you haven't said anything about chanting?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a chapter in the book about mantra. So.
The question was that we haven't said anything about chanting. And as Daniel pointed out, there's a chapter in the book about mantra. I mean, so mantra means that, you know, sacred syllables sometimes, there are various different understandings of it. It's not, the mantras are actually rarely chanted when, if I think about it, it's normally meant to be repeated mentally. And in fact, as the physical yoga traditions kind of coalesce over the last 1,000 years, they somewhat get rid of the mantra practice. And they just say that the in-breath and the out-breath is repeating the mantra Soham, which means I am that, which is the classical sort of Vedantic, you know, one of the philosophical systems of India is the mantra of that. So, yeah, chanting, in fact, in a traditional setting is more associated with devotional practice rather than the yoga traditions. But again, you know, that is a method of yoga as well, the bhakti yoga, which of course Krishna taught, and so the chanting would be central to that.
Yeah, you mentioned a little bit about Kanyang and you translate it as breath control, but I find that a strange translation. Could you go just a little further into what prana might actually mean for your practices and what the control of what prana might mean?
So prana is this this strange word that, you know, a very ancient concept that, that occurs, you know, well before Hatha Yoga and the sort of pranayama, you know, these breath control practices of Hatha Yoga. And it means, it's used in two senses. One is this sort of vital principle, this this essence of life, if you like, that flows through all things, particularly living beings. But it also means one of five sort of airs that are contained within the body, these winds that are contained in the body and that are controlled and manipulated through practices like breath control, as we call it, pranayama. But also through these other practices like mudra, these seals, which sort of direct and position the airs in order to effect usually a kind of upward movement of this prana through the central channel of the body. So for those of you that don't know, the yogic body is quite different to the sort of the biological body. It's not quite the same thing. It's sort of it has its own very complicated history. And the fact is that the longest chapter in the book is about these varieties of yogic body. So usually what prana does in certain tantric contexts, in the Hatha Yoga context, is to force this energy, these airs, into the central channel, up through the central channel, and often, usually, sort of out through the crown of the head. So that's one sort of, you know, context for this pranayama practice. Some people have sort of translated it as sort of, you know, expansion. But the practices that they're often, rather than pranayama, they're often referred to as kumbhaka, which means breath retention. So it's really, you know, it seems to be that the retention has a particularly important part to play. It's not just sort of, you know, breathing in and out gently. That sort of, you know, containing the air and directing the air is what's essential. You want to add to that?
Yeah, just to like, I mean, I understand your reservation about the translation of breath control. But what we do, if we look at it historically, which we do in the book, the earliest references to pranayama, it's tied in with this notion of austerity, of kind of extreme bodily practice. And the Buddha himself, you know, the Buddha tried various these ascetic techniques, including holding the breath for a very long period of time, till he says, you know, the fires were blazing in his stomach, and he reckons there's no way anyone could have gone further than that, but it still didn't get him to his goal. So the Buddha, of course, you know, then stops doing his practices and sits under a tree to attain enlightenment. But it's closely associated with these ascetic sort of methods of tormenting the body, and also within the orthodox Hindu scriptures, the kind of law books from a very early period. It's seen as a penance. You know, if you do something wrong, right, you have to go and do a little pranayama. You have to go and hold your breath in certain cycles for, you know, 100 cycles, 108 cycles, or something like that. And it's only a bit later on, within possibly, I suspect we've lost some sources, and within the later tantric traditions, so the end of the first millennium, but then we see them clearly in the Hatha Yoga text, where you get these more, breath control, or how, I don't know what to say, but these methods of manipulating the breath, which have these higher spiritual aims, you know, these strange ways of inhaling and exhaling and so forth. So I think early on, I think it's an okay translation, because it really is, it's meant to be sort of control and restraint and uncomfortable. But then later on, yeah, perhaps we should rethink the translation there.
And Hindu art, when they use it depicted, like for example, you know, like when the Buddha is seeking enlightenment, he's in a position that we call the lotus position. And for example, when Durga is slaying the demon, she's in a position we call the warrior pose. Is this accurate to use these terms for when, are they true asanas? Or that, I don't even know what my question is, but are we sort of retrofitting these concepts into?
Yes and no. With the lotus position, not at all. That's very much, an ancient pose. In fact, funny enough, I think the earliest reference to the lotus position is in the Kama Sutra, strangely enough, which is listed among various positions that can be used in lovemaking. But with that, absolutely not. That's, it's one of the oldest attested seated postures for meditation, or if not the oldest. But I think with the Durga and the Mahishasura Mardhini posture, calling that the warrior pose, now that is a retroactive attribution because we get no mention of a warrior pose in any Sanskrit text at all, do we? I don't think. I think the warrior pose is very much a, unless there was some obscure tradition that we don't know of that's not represented in text, something perhaps we should say is that we do try and incorporate information from our historical materials and ethnography and all other sources, not just the text. But it's pretty clear that the texts don't tell us everything. So, for example, in Hampi, in the amazing sort of the city in central southern India that was the biggest city in the world in the sort of 15th, 16th century, and there's amazing carvings on lots of temples there. And we see yogis in all sorts of postures which are not described in text at all. So that's a kind of clear sign that there were yoga traditions going on that are not represented by our texts. But I think with the warrior pose, so by the 18th, 19th century, though, just about everything is documented in text. So what was going on then? And I'm pretty sure there's no warrior pose in there. There is a Virasana, which you might translate as a warrior pose, but it's nothing like that posture. It's a sort of hot topic in Buddhist studies at the moment. Well, not specifically that. I see that as the hot topic. But what?
Jim, could you repeat the question?
Oh, sorry. The question is basically saying the Buddha was doing yoga, and that's downplayed. People don't acknowledge that. Just about all of our historical scholarly studies of Buddhism are based on what's called the Pali Canon, so these texts in Pali, which is a kind of Cockney version of Sanskrit, sort of. That's probably being a bit rude, but anyway, it's a vernacular form of Sanskrit in a way. The oldest manuscripts of any of the texts of the Pali Canon are from the 15th century CE. Okay, so only 500 or 600 years ago. And sure, they're going to preserve some things from 2,000 years earlier, which is when the Buddha lived, but things are pretty certain to have changed. Within the version of the Buddha's life preserved in the Pali Canon is this story that he tried these techniques. I was saying to Rodney about how he held his breath. In fact, he did this, he did something strange with his tongue. He mentions these various things. And then in that version of the story, he decides that they're all rubbish, they're useless. He goes and sits under the Bodhi tree and gets enlightened. In the last few decades, much, much older manuscripts, particularly in the northwest of the Indian subcontinent, have been discovered. Manuscripts last much longer, they're drier, in the drier climate. So in caves in China and also in the northwest of Pakistan, there are now documents, manuscripts from, I think the oldest are just over 2,000 years, and some are just into the first millennium AD. And in those narratives, but they're much more fragmentary. We don't have the whole sort of canon like we do with the Pali canon. But in those tellings of the life of the Buddha, he does these practices, and he stops doing them. He goes and sits under the Bodhi tree, but he doesn't say they were rubbish. It's like they're a step on the path. You know, so one might argue. And also from that same region, I mean, you've probably seen statues of the fasting Buddha. You know, so you see the statue, it's incredibly gaunt and his face is totally tucked in and all his ribs are showing and everything. And that often, you know, I long wondered if he said that those practices of fasting and breath control and, you know, these are more extreme forms of yoga, were they good? Why would they then depict him doing them? And these all come from the same region as well, where this sort of different textual tradition survives. So, and it's taking a while to filter through into the academy, because the old guard, who have spent their whole careers interpreting the Pali Canon, don't like this at all, you know, because their life's work is being questioned. And so it's kind of a young generation of scholars, younger than I am, but some very good young scholars are kind of, well, they're not all younger than I am, there's one or two, but it's taking a while, but I think in 20 or 30 years that will be the new orthodoxy about the history of the Buddha.
This is kind of counterfactual. If the text had disappeared, would the physical tradition, or could the physical tradition, have continued?
Yes, absolutely. I think, I mean, that's a sort of, I mean, point I'm trying to make earlier is that, you know, we know the physical practices were going on from 2,500 years ago, but they don't get codified in text until 1,000 years ago. So they're perfectly, you know, they were able to be transmitted over that period. And again, we find, you know, there are things like, there's one text from about 1200 that calls the headstand Kapali, which is Kapala is a word for the skull, so you're standing on your skull. And then that this word Kapali doesn't crop up again in any text for about another 600 or 700 years. But it clearly must have been being used in that intervening period. So we, you know, the text, to a great extent, I think, are adjunct to the actual the tradition, the lineages that are passing down these practices already.
The question is, why has yoga gone global in the last several years? Well, I suppose yoga has gone global in the last couple of hundred years, as you know, but it's certainly speeding up in the last decades. The reason for that was that India was suddenly opened to, not suddenly, but in more open to the world. And was being looked at and studied, and there was a kind of fascination with what was going on in India initially, and many people from Europe and America sort of going there and sort of poking around and saying, oh, what's this? And so then yoga started to become, that word yoga started to become a kind of household name, and people started to get very interested in it. Initially as not something that you would do, but something that you would sort of gawp at. And, you know, as yoga practitioners were among the most colourful of the religious practitioners in India. So this is a long story, as you know, that I won't go into. But at a certain point, yoga became something that you could actually do. People started to come over from India and teach it, and others started to teach it without any kind of sort of, you know, training in yoga. And suddenly you had this sort of expansion and this explosion of yoga. Why now has it become so popular? I don't know. I mean, there have been several sort of explosions in yoga. That first one, sort of towards the end of the 19th century, with a teacher called Vivekananda, who came to New York and remained in New York on the East Coast for a number of years, and sort of, you know, started this revolution. And then, you know, you have the 60s explosion of yoga, which was quite different to the yoga that you see around today. For one thing, there were no lycra pants back in the 60s. There were
all mats.
Sorry?
Or sticky mats.
The sticky mat, in fact, has a very recent history. It came about through, I believe, and maybe there's people here that could speak to this better than I can. It came about because this is a story I heard recently in India, that it was one student of BKS Iyengar who had no sweat glands in her hands. This is Angela Farmer. And so requested special permission to use this sticky mat because she couldn't, you know, on the floor, she would slide around all over the place. And lo and behold, now you can't go anywhere without a sticky mat. And as to the popularity of yoga, I don't know. I mean, I've speculated in the past as to why, but certainly it seems to answer a deep need. It seems like everybody is doing yoga, and every year the spending on yoga increases, the number of people doing yoga increases according to the surveys, and it also seems to be sort of crash proof. So the worse the economy gets, the better the yoga economy gets. And perhaps there's something there that in times of great instability, then yoga provides something that's stable and that sort of, you know, answers a need.
Yes, sort of actually
follow
on from that, really. I wonder what the ascetics and the yogis, in as much as they care, make of the yoga that's traveled around the world. And Do they resent it? Do they like it? Do they capitalize on it?
Jim seems to have found people copying it.
Yes, to some extent. Yeah, I mean, they do. They make a distinction actually, because yoga is a Sanskrit word, and so it's pronounced yoga. But when Sanskrit words are used in vernacular languages in India, they drop the final A. So in Hindi, yoga is not yoga, it's yog. And so the sadhus that I spend time with, they make a distinction between yog, which is what they do, and yoga, which is what's going on in the sort of metropolises in India and in the West. I mean, it's pretty huge in India as well. But I was there a couple of weeks ago, and I was driving up to the Himalayas, and I'm going through a pretty small town, a village, and there was a sign up for it was weightlift, bodybuilding, and yoga. I wish I'd stopped and taken the picture. Actually, I was quite surprised. But yeah, they see a distinction between the two. But at the same time, this project that Mark and I are working on, when we pitched it to the European Research Council, one of the things to try and underscore the urgency of particularly the ethnographic side of the project. So the Daniela, who was mentioned earlier, who is in India, documenting the practices of traditional yogis, to underscore the urgency of that, because I pointed out how it's changing extremely quickly at the moment because of this, because we're all so connected now. So there's one yogi in particular that I met, who a young guy, and his lineage, his tradition, I was working on a paper at the time, they are often credited with being the founders of physical yoga practice. But none of them anyone met did any physical yoga practice. And then I met this guy, and there he was young, he was probably 21, 22, and he did this amazing kind of contortionist bendy routine of yoga postures. And so I think I'm going to have to rewrite this completely. You know, this has really blown my theory out of the water. And I got talking to him, and I asked him, I said, so who's your guru? Who in your lineage taught you these practices? He said, oh, no, it came directly to me from Guru Gorakhnath, who's the sort of thousand-year-old founder of the sect. And this guy, this was 5 or 6 years ago, and he was pretty useful on his mobile telephone as well, and social media and so forth. And he kept saying to me, you know, if I knew English, I'd be world famous, wouldn't I? You know, and I'm completely convinced that he was looking at modern globalized yoga practice on TV or through his mobile phone and stuff, and was teaching himself some of the practices like that. So it's changing fast, you know, because it's become this huge global phenomenon. We're all so connected. It's getting harder and harder to identify the different threads that make it up.
Can you take what you just said and
Yes, that's a good question. The question is, you know, where did it come from? Where did it start, effectively? That's, so what the kind of consensus these days, and when we have a passage from one text, what they call the Atharva Veda, which is the latest of the four Vedas, so the most ancient text of Hinduism, probably about 1000 BC. But that's pretty sketchy. There's just a few kind of ideas that we then find in later yoga texts. It's in no way a kind of description of yoga practice. And the first, or what we would understand as yoga practice, and when it seems that the time that it seems that yoga really kind of breaks into the, comes out, it becomes apparent in Indian history, is around the 4th or 5th centuries BC, when the Buddha lived. And what appears to have happened then is in a region called Magadha, which is just sort of south, it's northern India in the Ganges basin, just south of Nepal. There are these various ascetic traditions which are collectively known as shramanas. That means the strivers, the ones who are striving towards something. And it's amongst those traditions that lots of things develop for the first time in India, including ideas of karma, you know, so that what you do will then affect what happens to you later on, and the associated notion of samsara, so the wheel of transmigration and rebirth. And at the same time, this notion of being constantly reborn over unlimited lives going on forever is then seen as a bad thing, you know, because life is associated with suffering, and I think it probably was in those days probably much more closely associated with suffering, much shorter, a lot more disease going on, famine, and you know, people constantly fighting and so forth. So life was seen as suffering, and these shramanas were devising techniques to break free of this, and that's the notion of enlightenment. This is the first time that these concepts appear. So they're all coming up with different ways of breaking free of this cycle of suffering. And yoga is one of them. And also another concept that appears there is ahimsa, which is normally translated as non-violence. So that kind of answer your question about diet, that's when this notion of vegetarianism appears, because despite what people may tell you at that time, the Hindu traditions, the word Hindu wasn't used, but what we would now call Hindu traditions, they weren't all vegetarian by any stretch of the imagination. And it's among these kind of yogi ascetic groups that this concept of non-violence, which is therefore creating good karma and then giving you a better reward in later life, that appears. So yeah, it seems to be there.
One last question, if anybody has.
Maybe answer more about what's going on now, but that's absolutely the tension that I'm getting at, that we find within the texts that represent the tradition. There is this constant kind of tension between is this a sort of method of bodily mortification, or is it a thing for cultivating the body? Do you scorn the body? Do you think it's a horrible sort of bag of, you know, you get these texts saying it's a horrible bag of phlegm and pus and fat and you don't want this thing at all, and it's to be transcended, or you get other texts which say, you know, through these practices we will make it perfect and we can live like divine beings. And so, yeah, we're just perpetuating the tension between the two, and I can't give you an answer either way. I mean, I think that what one can take from the traditions is that one can choose either, you know, the argument continues to go on, so you know, neither approach is wrong or right. Both are right.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think there is a tradition that's critical of these difficult practices, these tapas practices, or of hatha yoga in general. where these people say that there's no point doing difficult practices because you can attain to the same goal in much, much easier ways through these practices, which are easy, which often involve sort of, you know, well, sitting down and say, you know, looking at one spot for a long time, or just, you know, relaxing the mind. And the analogy that's drawn in one of the texts is how to corral a beast. One way is to go out there with a stick and start shouting and start, you know, sort of hitting and dragging the animal back in, which is going to take you a long, long time. You're going to be sweaty, you're going to be exhausted. The other method is to go out there with a handful of grass and talk to the animal very gently and sort of scratch it behind its ear and gradually bring it in with sort of much less effort, but the goal is the same. So as Jim's saying, you know, that tension is still here. And as to why practices have, like, so positive practices have apparently gotten much harder since that sort of second wave that I was thinking about that I was talking about during the 60s, well, who's to know? I don't know. I wonder if it sort of matches a sort of impression that life should be hard, that life, you know, needs to be sort of, that in order to get anywhere, you need to work hard, no pain, no gain. That sort of mantra may be filtering through into yoga as well.
Could it be Instagram?
it's about the display of what you're doing as much as it is about, you know, the performance side of it. Anyway, thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Daniel, as well, for jumping in at the last minute.
Thank you. will be here, but my name will be the second time, or every time. Oh my God, always.
Thank you. Oh.